We know that climate change is dramatically and adversely affecting habitats of many endangered species. Now, research indicates it's also skewing the male-to-female ratio of certain animals. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guests in the first half hour, Robert Litterman and Rory Telemico, two Iowa State University researchers who are studying how climate change may be reducing males in populations of turtles, lizards, and fish. Then in the second half hour, geologist Chris Brochu of the University of Iowa on the disappearance of the dinosaurs. That's all coming up this hour, right after the news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, it's all about the effects of climate change. In the second half hour, we're going to travel back in time to a change in the Earth's climate just over 66 million years ago. We'll talk about new research that reinforces the theory that the extinction of the dinosaurs coincides with the impact of a massive asteroid. What happened to the dinosaurs? That age-old question in our second half hour. But first, climate change now. In this day and age, we know climate change in our time is dramatically and adversely affecting habitats of many endangered species. But it's also skewing the male-to-female ratio of certain animals. And that research and its possible implications is something we want to talk about this first half hour. My guests are two Iowa State University researchers, two PhD candidates at ISU's Department of Ecology, Evolution, and Organismal Biology. Robert Litterman is with us, and Rory Telemico.
Hi.
In our Ames studio. Good afternoon to both of you.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
We want to mention that both of you will be making a presentation about this for the Science Center of Iowa's CAFE Scientific Series, March 5th at 5 p.m. at the Science Center in Des Moines. Let's lay a little groundwork before we get to exactly what the two of you are studying. And I know you have slightly different specialties in this area, in ecology, evolution, and organismal biology. So please jump in when you see the question more pertinent for you or the other one, Robert or Rory. Before we get to the climate change, tell us, because I was not aware of this, that when we talk about sex determination, it happens different depending on the species. For instance, tell us how it happens in mammals.
So in mammals, like humans, all mammals have their sex determined by the DNA that they inherit from their parents. You get half of the DNA from your mother, half from your father. And depending on whether or not your father either gives you an X chromosome or a Y chromosome will determine whether or not you're a male or a female. Males have an X and a Y chromosome. Females have two X chromosomes.
Okay. So when those come together, that's the determination that we've heard. And we want to be clear in this conversation that sex and gender are not synonymous, are they?
No, they're actually very different. Sex is a biological term. Gender is a social construction, and it's something that's very important and near and dear to a lot of people's hearts, but it is important to disentangle the two.
Okay. So now let's move to your area of expertise. Some species where the sex is determined by temperature. How does that work, and for which species?
Well, there are a number of species, actually, that have sex-determining mechanisms that are different from the sort of stereotypical chromosomal sex determination system. And probably the most common of those, in vertebrate animals at least, is temperature-dependent sex determination. And all this means is that during, when the embryo is first formed, the sex hasn't yet been determined. And at some point, generally in the middle third of development, the embryo is suddenly labile. And over that middle third of development, environmental cues determine what sex the embryo will become. With species with temperature-dependent sex determination, it's the temperature. The most common form of this has warmer temperatures inducing female production and cooler temperatures producing male production. But there are other forms as well. It can be the reverse. We can have cool temperatures produce females, warm temperatures produce males, or even an intermediate temperature producing females and then both extremes producing males.
Mm-hmm. Be more specific about the species we're talking about.
Well, it's most common in reptiles. It's found across the turtles, though not all turtles, some lizards, The tuatara, which looks a bit like a lizard, but it's not. They're only found in New Zealand. There's two species. And
all crocodilians?
All crocodilians, right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. A fish?
Some fish have temperature-dependent sex determination, but there's also a lot of other kind of cool things going on in fish where the size of the individual can actually spur whether or not they become a male or a female, the pH of the water. Mm-hmm. Fish have a lot going on.
Are these all species, also the ones you've named, are egg-laying, or some of them not?
The vast majority are egg-laying. There are a couple species that are live-bearing or viviparous that at least seem to have some thermal sensitivity, though we don't have it all worked out yet, exactly what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the climate is getting warmer. As many of us heard, President Obama stated in his State of the Union address this year, the 12 hottest years have been in the past 15 years. In fact, 2012 was the hottest year on record. What have you been looking into with these sex determinations of species and how our climate is changing? What's going on? What are you looking at?
Well, the concern is that if it gets a little bit warmer, because these species change in a degree or even 2 degrees can be all that matters between whether or not they're a male or a female. It's that subtle. So if we have a even small change in temperature of 1 or 2 degrees, or if it's more dramatic, as is starting to be predicted, like 6 to 8 degrees, there's the potential to see complete shifts from one sex to the other, which could result in the end in population extinction. If you have completely female populations, they can no longer reproduce, and that's bad.
Mm-hmm. Possible, but have you looked at it? Have we seen any indication that we are seeing this skewing of the male to female ratio?
We are actually seeing shifts in a number of populations. There's the population that my laboratory works on primarily. Dr. Fred Jansen has been working with this population of painted turtles on the Mississippi River for over 25 years now. And we see in warmer years, we definitely see complete female bias sex ratios. And in fact, the last couple years here in the Midwest, we've gone through some very, very warm, dry years. And we've seen very high biases in sex ratio towards females.
Mm-hmm. And this is Rory talking, right?
Yes.
Rory, you're involved, while we're on the subject of turtles, you're involved in a summer program called Turtle Camp, I believe. Tell us more about that.
So Turtle Camp is a program sponsored by my laboratory where, it's sort of the general name for just our entire research endeavor out on this island and on the Mississippi River. And we go out every year and spend 3 to 6 weeks tracking all the females as they come on land. They're marked. We then look at the eggs, count them, weigh them, that sort of thing. Leave them to incubate for the entire gestation period or incubation period, and then come back in the fall and examine the offspring to see what sex they are and also measure a number of other things.
Mm-hmm. And what have you been noticing about our turtle population here in the Midwest?
Well, as I said, they are generally in the past few years in particular shifting towards females. However, there's a lot of other things that go on with the climate. We have warm years and cool years, and they generally do track. The mean temperature in July is a really good predictor of whether or not we're going to see all males or all females at this population. And as that temperature increases and we have more extreme spikes in temperature, we're seeing more and more females being produced.
Mm-hmm. For instance, last year, 2012, very warm, early and warm spring. How did the turtles react to that?
Well, for starters, they started nesting dramatically earlier in the year. Weeks earlier in the year, they began nesting, which is a major shift we're actually seeing in a lot of organisms. Their timing of reproduction is shifting up. This isn't just turtles. It's frogs and it's birds and even plants. Trees are flowering earlier and bud burst is happening earlier. Mm-hmm. And then again, we've seen the nests actually are getting warmer and it is affecting the sex ratios of the offspring. Mm-hmm. In addition, it's affecting whether or not the offspring even survive.
Mm. Robert, perhaps you could talk a little bit more about, this is interesting that temperature determining sex in some species begs the question of why would nature make it this way in terms of evolution?
It's a great question, and it's a question that people have been wrestling with for the past 40 years since people have been researching environmental sex determination. One important thing to keep in mind when we're talking about temperature-dependent sex determination or any sort of environmental sex determination, recall when we talked about the genetic sex determination, the X and the Y system, what we're replacing in the environmental sex determination is that trigger, the trigger that's going to set the organism down a certain developmental pathway. Temperature replacing that trigger might not be that dramatic of a shift. And so what we see actually, if we look across all the vertebrates, temperature-dependent sex determination has been gained and lost in most lineages where it's found. And so as a broad statement, it might be neutral, shifting back and forth. Now,
just natural sort of variations that don't mean much.
Defining an adaptive value to it isn't always going to tell you why it's evolving, though. Research done by a member of Rory's lab, Dan Warner, who is now off in greener pastures doing other work, he actually did a research study in Australia studying Jackie Dragons, and what they found was that these Jackie Dragons have temperature-dependent sex determination, but what they were able to do was sort of chemically reverse the sex to force these animals to be either male or female. And what they found was that when the Jackie Dragons were born at the appropriate temperature, so when you have a female that was raised at a female incubation temperature or vice versa with the males, they actually had higher success down the road. They were more well-suited to be a female or a male if they were raised at the correct temperature as opposed to if they were reversed. So there are preliminary results that suggest that there could be an adaptive benefit, but when we see this gain and loss so many times over the evolution of vertebrates, it's quite possible that it exists more on a continuum and there might be a natural flux back and forth.
You just joined us, my guest this half hour, two Iowa State University researchers, two PhD candidates at ISU's Department of Ecology, Evolution, and Organismal Biology. We were just listening to Robert Litterman there, Rory Telemico with him in our Ames studio, talking about how climate change may affect the male-to-female ratio in certain species, some of the research that they're doing there. And I think it was you, Rory, earlier, who brought up that, okay, so warmer temperatures in many of these species bring us a higher female ratio in this too. So you started to go in the direction that this could endanger some of the species. How?
Well, it's a definite concern. If a population becomes either mostly male or mostly female, there is the potential for it to reduce the actual breeding population size of that population.
If we have, let's say, chickens, and we have 15 hens and one rooster, we don't worry about that, do we?
No, we don't. Right, there is the potential that if we have all these females and there's that one male available, it will allow the population to at least reproduce that generation. Mm-hmm. However, we have also reduced the number of individuals in the breeding pool by only having that one male. And what this does is it restricts the genetic variation going into that population, which really reduces that population's ability to handle large-scale environmental variation in at least an adaptive manner through an evolutionary process. You end up having issues like inbreeding depression and things of that nature.
Mm-hmm. Also, a very unfortunate event that the large boulder rolls down the hill and crushes your one male is extremely detrimental if you've only got the one. Ideally, you'd want to have a couple more for backup.
Okay. Okay. So what are you suggesting? Are you suggesting something be done about this?
Ideally, that would be perfect.
Do we know enough at this point? Because you said there are still a lot of open questions here. Do we know enough about it to act? And what would we do if we did?
There are very few species where we actually know enough to act. And a large goal of my laboratory, the laboratory I'm in, a number of other laboratories around the world, is figuring out, one, what is really going on? Where are the thermal cues being involved? At what point during development? What temperatures are inducing these cues? How important is how variable the temperature is versus just a constant temperature like we can most easily reproduce in the laboratory? So we need to understand the physiology and the biology of these organisms before we could act. Mm-hmm. We also, an important question is whether or not sort of skewing the population sex ratio is going to be the most important sort of nail in the coffin for a population. It could be that these more extreme temperatures are actually keeping them from being able to develop and hatch in the first place, which is an even bigger problem than having not enough males is having no individuals hatching to begin with.
Mm-hmm. We know through the Earth has gone through all kinds of climate variations and fluctuations over time. Species normally, what, adapt or die out, or what?
Right. That's exactly your options. You adapt or die out. And you can adapt either through a straightforward evolutionary process where you have genetic changes over time in a population, or through changes in behavior, more plastic changes that an individual can do. So say a female digging a deeper nest or nesting more in the shade. That sort of thing could happen on a faster time scale. And those are the ways a population could sort of naturally compensate for climate change.
Mm-hmm.
However, as you mentioned, many of these species have been around, or at least these lineages have been around, through very dramatic changes in climate. The big difference is how rapidly this is occurring. In the past, massive changes in climate generally took thousands, if not tens of thousands of years to progress, which give a lot of generations, a lot of time for a population to slowly evolve to changes in the environment. If you have massive changes in environment that happen over a century, like we're projecting, many of these organisms, many turtles, live 20, 50, even 75 years and have very long generation times, which gives very, very little opportunity for an evolutionary process to happen.
Mm-hmm. There are some reptile species where females, I understand, develop in environments of extreme cold or extreme warmth, and males develop in between. Do you think this is a result of climate change?
So that pattern, that type 2 temperature-dependent sex, as that's known, it's an interesting pattern. Actually, what happens is if you take type 1, where you've got the cool males and the warm females, and you put it right next to the other type 1B, where you've got cool females and warm males, it actually forms. You can imagine that type 2 might have been an ancestral state, and where you have the intermediate males, and they simply diverged, and one end of that developmental spectrum fell off and became either fatal or otherwise. So the development of that intermediate stage might actually represent an ancestral state.
Mm-hmm. You are two PhD candidates at Iowa State University's Department of Ecology, Evolution, and Organismal Biology. Let me first ask, what are the burning questions in your field of science?
So I can start. What our lab is working on specifically, we're really at the subcellular, at the genetic level, and sometimes even smaller than that.
This is Robert.
This is, yeah.
Okay, Robert Litterman. Mm-hmm.
Yes. What our lab's trying to figure out is, throughout vertebrate evolution, how has the DNA of these genes that we know help determine sex across vertebrates? So a lot of the same genes are used in humans and turtles and fish. And it's just how they're turned on and off that's really changing. So our lab works to figure out how those genes are being differentially expressed. And one thing that we really don't know is we know temperature can change sex. We actually even know that temperature can affect how the DNA is turned on and off. We don't know yet what is happening inside that developing embryo. How is that temperature signal being translated? What is the protein? What's happening inside the cells to say it's warmer, start the female developmental pathway? So a lot of what we're working on in our lab is trying to get at the mechanism underlying temperature-dependent sex determination.
And why temperature-sex determination seems to only be present in the reptiles and fish, for instance.
Yeah, the distribution of temperature-dependent sex determination is something that is pretty interesting. Now, to an extent, you can think about how it really wouldn't work in mammals. Because mammals incubate their offspring, with the exception of a handful, inside a temperature-controlled womb. And without that temperature fluctuation, temperature-dependent sex determination really wouldn't work. We hold human embryos at a pretty constant temperature, so you'd have all one sex.
Mm-hmm.
Birds also actively will maintain their nest and keep it at a pretty steady temperature. But the distribution, for instance, within the turtles alone shows multiple gains and losses, and studying at the genetic level what's happening with those genes and how they're being regulated is something that our lab's really interested in.
And to you, Rory Telemico, tell us the burning questions that you're looking at the start of your career.
Well, I really, and my lab's research focus, really want to understand how changes in the environment really affect the ecology and the evolution of organisms, which is a huge question that I'm never going to be able to answer all of. But it's, as we mentioned earlier, climate and the environment has changed dramatically in the past. We know that environments are changing now due to climate change, due to invasive species, due to habitat instruction and people being there and building. And organisms do respond, and they can respond through evolutionary processes or through plastic sort of physiological processes. And we really don't have a great grasp of how these organisms can or cannot respond, sort of what parts of their physiology really set their limits on where they can and can't live. What's really defining where, like I said, where they can and can't live. And so what I really want to do is understand these different limits on organisms, which we then can put into models and actually predict how future changes might affect these animals or plants or anything, and determine where they might end up, how they might survive, which ones will and won't survive, and maybe then be able to make a really well-educated conservation plan.
I'm curious. This is a fascinating area of science that both of you are involved in. I'm just curious, as kids, maybe teenagers, did you have sort of formative experiences that you look back on now as you start your career in ecology, evolution, organismal biology, that you can say, wow, that's where whatever my switch was flipped on to study this more in depth?
So this is Bob. My mother is terrified of almost all reptiles. So growing up, I was told, don't catch that snake, put that frog down. You know, anything that she perceived as slimy or cold, she didn't like. And that just made me more and more interested.
Where did you grow up, Bob?
Buffalo, New York.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And
So it was an act of rebellion.
It was. My love of reptiles was purely an act of rebellion. And it stuck with me. And I bought pets and I bred them, and that's how I found out about temperature dependent sex determination was through raising my little geckos. And I just, the second I read about that in the care sheet, I was hooked, and I've been doing it for researching it actively for seven years now.
An act of rebellion for you too, Rory, as a child? No,
not so much. I was helped along a little bit more. I was, if you remember the movie Old Yeller, the little boy with the horned lizards in his pockets and
yes,
the toads and the
yes.
snakes, that was basically me growing up in central Oklahoma. Uh-huh. I love these animals. My parents were great with it. Actually, one of my first memories is being in a canoe with my dad and trying to grab the snapping turtle that's eating the bluegill we have strung behind, and my dad freaking out because he thought that I was going to get my hand bit off.
So your bedroom as a kid was full of other creatures?
They didn't let me have all that much, which was kind of a bummer. I only caught things in the summer and then let them go. But I did have, I had the dinosaur bed sheets. I had the works.
You did. Tell us a little bit. You'll be making this presentation for the Science Center of Iowa's CAFE Scientific Series, March 5th, 5:30 at the Science Center of Iowa in Des Moines. What else can people expect when they attend that?
So it's actually at Java Joe's in Des Moines.
Okay.
It's going to be a really neat talk. We're really excited about it. We're going to go through talking about some of the topics we talked about today, getting into more detail into some of the models, and entertaining a lot of questions from the public. So I'll let Rory
We're also
jump in.
Addressing some more just sort of basic questions like why have more than one sex to begin with? Mm-hmm. If you have two, how many of each should you have, which we talked about briefly here. And then going into some of the nitty-gritty of how you would develop into a male or a female, and then a little bit more about climate change predictions and our modeling and really trying to understand how these organisms may or may not be affected by impending climate change.
Sounds fascinating. Thank you, Roy Telemico and Bob Litterman for joining us, two Iowa State University researchers. It's been a pleasure spending the half hour with you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up in just a moment, we'll talk about climate change, but climate change from way back when. What happened to the dinosaurs? That age-old question. Geologist Chris Brochu of the University of Iowa will talk about new research that reinforces the theory that their extinction coincided with the impact of a massive asteroid just over 66 million years ago. But there may have been other factors. We'll talk about that when we come back. Also, your questions about the extinction of the dinosaurs, if you have them, 1-866-780-9100. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Years before Jim Lehrer was a news anchor on PBS, he worked at a bus depot.
Now leaving from lane one for Inez, Edna, Ganeda, Louise, El Campo, Pierce, Wharton, Hungerford, Kendleton, Beasley, Rosenberg, Richmond, Sugarland, Stafford, Missouri City, and Houston. All aboard! Don't forget your baggage, please.
Jim Lehrer on Bullseye from PRI.
Sunday evening at 7 on Iowa Public Radio. Support comes from Graceland University in Lamoni, home of the Edmund J. Glaser School of Education, offering several Masters of Education programs. Graceland University, home for higher education. More at graceland.edu.
Back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. Climate change, our topic today. But this half hour, we want to travel back in time to talk about climate change a long, long time ago, when dinosaurs still roamed the Earth, some 66 million years ago. About 75% of species on Earth disappeared. It wasn't just dinosaurs. Most large mammals, fish, birds, plankton, and scientists have known this for a long time from looking at the fossil record. But scientists haven't been trying to figure out what exactly caused this mass extinction. Well, back in 1980, a new theory surfaced, and the one we've heard about so much since that time, near what is now the Mexican town of Chicxulub on the Yucatan Peninsula, an asteroid. And this one was a biggie. More than 5 miles across, slammed into the Earth. It caused tsunamis, earthquakes, threw up a huge cloud of dust, smothering the world. According to a new study released earlier this month, dinosaurs died off about 33,000 years after that asteroid hit the Earth. And that's much sooner than scientists had believed, and the asteroid may have not been the sole cause of this extinction. Joining me now to talk about this new study and how that may change our thinking of what happened to the dinosaurs and about this period of mass extinction, Chris Brochu. He is an associate professor of geology at the University of Iowa. He specializes in vertebrate paleontology. Chris Brochu, welcome to our program.
Hi.
Well, let's talk about this new study initially. These researchers say that they can now prove that a giant asteroid more than 5 miles across did in fact hit the Earth right before the extinction. For you studying in this area, how do these findings change our understanding, if at all?
To be honest, they don't. And I actually disagree with their assertion that they can pinpoint the extinction of land vertebrates like dinosaurs so closely to the asteroid impact, because our ability to tell precise time for land animals is not nearly as good as our ability to do it for marine organisms, which is what most people look at when they're trying to tell time from the geological record. There are three basic questions that are being addressed here. One, did an asteroid or something big hit the Earth about 65 million years ago? The answer to that question is an unambiguous yes. The evidence for that is overwhelming. Nobody questions that. The second question, how closely did this coincide with any of the mass extinctions that took place around the world around that time? It's pretty close. I still think that our ability to tell precise time in that particular kind of time range is a little bit tricky, but the reason this paper came about is that a few years ago, another study argued that the asteroid impact at Chicxulub was closer to 300,000 years prior to the mass extinction. These new authors are saying, no, it's a lot closer to that. So the paper argues that there's a closer correlation between the asteroid impact and the mass extinctions.
And do you think their data is okay?
Their data are okay, yeah. I don't question their data. I question how well we're able to correlate this one event with land-based events, mass extinctions among land animals, as opposed to marine animals. Again, our ability to tell fine levels of time in the marine geological record is much better.
Why? Because when animals have a mass extinction in marine, they sink to the bottom.
Well, the
and
fossil
they make a layer or what?
Well, the fossil record is a lot more precise. We can say more about time levels over a broader geographic range. The fossils are simply more amenable to that sort of thing. So it's just a matter of how precisely we can tell time. Now, the third question is whether this asteroid impact was the direct cause of extinction for land animals, or for animals and organisms in general. That one, I think, this paper does not address. And I don't think the authors pretend that it does either. And I still am skeptical that the asteroid impact was the main cause.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you're differentiating between types of causes. Talk about that. So you say not the direct cause, but perhaps
the ultimate cause. Okay, think of it this way. How many people die as a direct cause of AIDS every year? And the answer is none. Nobody dies directly of AIDS. They die of AIDS-related complications. They die of pneumonia. They die of certain cancers associated with AIDS, with HIV infection. AIDS would be the ultimate cause of death, but the direct cause of death would be something caused by the collapse of your immune system. In the same way, we can look at the asteroid impact as possibly the ultimate cause of extinction, but what were the direct causes? That would be things like this sudden period of darkness and cold that's been proposed. Supposedly lots of acid rain. pH of rain was supposed to go way down because of material thrown into the atmosphere, things like that. And the problem we have is that, at least again for land vertebrates, which is what I study, the patterns of extinction we see are actually in some cases the opposite of what we would expect from these direct causes.
How so?
For example, and this is one that was done by a good friend and colleague of mine by the name of Ann Weil. Acid rain is a real problem today. Okay, we are dealing with the effects of industrial acid in rain that's been acidifying lakes and freshwater streams. The groups of organisms that are affected the most today by acid rain in freshwater, things like freshwater fish, amphibians, they're the groups that are affected least at this mass extinction event. We would expect them to be hit very hard, and in fact, they're barely hit at all. The mass extinction on land was a very selective event. If you were big, you were more likely to go extinct. Now, the asteroid impact would explain some of that because the dark and cold snap would have wiped out plants. There is evidence for a mass die-off of plants, which would have had an impact on large herbivores and things like that. But if you were in freshwater, if you were an ectotherm, if you were cold-blooded in the conventional sense, chances are you did quite well. And a lot of the changes that we would propose from the asteroid impact would be expected to have a larger impact on them than they did. So no one questions that the asteroid impact took place. Most of us would agree that it had a profound impact on land ecosystems and certainly on marine ecosystems as well. But we don't necessarily know that it was the only cause of extinction at that time.
But you are willing to say it was one cause.
Oh, perhaps. Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Okay. So what if we talk about other factors, other things that we see from the fossil record going on at this time, what might be some other explanations that coincided to bring about this mass extinction?
Well, there were several. There were also large volcanic eruptions going on in what's today India, the Indian subcontinent. The problem there is that a lot of the direct causes from the volcanic events would be similar to those by the asteroid impact, so they would be very difficult to distinguish in the fossil record. But we also had some substantial changes in sea level, and we had changes in climate that may or may not have been related to the changes in sea level. Now, changes in sea level, first of all, would have a major impact on marine organisms because as the sea drains, the amount of continental shelf, shallow marine areas where a lot of organisms live is going to be cut back. Okay, you're also going to be having an impact on ocean circulation patterns, which is going to change regional climate, maybe even global climate. You're going to be rearranging the connections between land masses, which causes organisms to move from one place to another. One of the major causes of extinction today is invasive species, species that are brought over by accident or on purpose and to an area where they don't belong and cause a lot of problems. These connections would generally lead to lots and lots of invasive species. Mm-hmm. Now, the patterns we see can't be explained by that either entirely.
Did our land masses look differently than they do today, vastly differently?
They were starting to look like they do now. There were still some differences. India was still separated from the rest of Asia. It was still an island continent. Connections between North and South America were tenuous at best. North America up to that time had been cut in half by a shallow seaway that ran from what's today the Gulf of Mexico up to Hudson's Bay. Now, that seaway was draining and rising multiple times. This was a period of time where it was dropping pretty quickly. And so for the first time in a while, there was actually a dry land connection between the western and eastern coasts of North America.
Mm. If you just joined us, Chris Brochu is my guest, associate professor of geology at the University of Iowa, specializing in vertebrate paleontology. We're using a new study about the impact the asteroid might have had on mass extinction some 65, 66 million years ago as a jumping off point to talk about climate change way back then. And if you have any questions, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Why do you think this study got so much press?
Well, I think that a couple of reasons. First of all, this is a hot topic. Everyone loves dinosaurs. My love of them has diminished over time, but still many people love dinosaurs. People are fascinated by the fact that you could go from one type of landscape where the world is ruled by very large predatory and herbivorous dinosaurs to one where those dinosaurs are gone and they're replaced by larger mammals in a fairly short period of geological time. How did that happen? We don't know. It's a fascinating problem. If not for this mass extinction event, you and I would not be sitting here. The only reason humans came into being is because the large land animals that had been suppressing the large mammals for so long disappeared.
Mm-hmm. And so what would have been the closest mammal to pre-humans existing at this period?
That's an interesting question. There's one fossil that may or may not be from that period of time. It's called Purgatorius. And it's thought to be an early relative of primates, something called a plesiadapiform. The problem is we don't really know whether it's from the late Cretaceous, the very last part of the age of dinosaurs, or from the earliest part of the age of mammals, because it was collected in an area called the Bug Creek localities. Now, Bug Creek is an interesting place. It's out in Montana, and the fossils are not collected by paleontologists at first. They're collected by ants. Hmm. The ants in that area, there are kinds of ants that will collect small fossil teeth, small mammal teeth. Purgatorius would have been a very small animal, maybe the size of a chipmunk at most.
So it looked something like a chipmunk?
Maybe a little bit more like a tree shrew, if you know what that looks like.
Sure.
But these animals were very small, but they had very small teeth. These teeth happened to be just the right shape and size to go into the ants' nests. And so people will often go to these ant nests and collect the teeth out of there. The problem is we don't know exactly where the ant got the tooth. Did the ant get the tooth from Cretaceous rocks or from somewhat younger rocks? It's a little bit difficult to tell sometimes.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if in teaching paleontology as a professor of geology at the University of Iowa, if you have students or people, perhaps you meet people in the community who find out about your fascinating area of science and come in with common misperceptions about the period when the dinosaurs lived. For instance, that humans coincided with the dinosaurs.
Well, they do, but not in the way they think. Okay, so one of the biggest misconceptions is that dinosaurs are extinct, and they are not. There are 10,000 species of dinosaur alive today. We call them birds. Okay?
Okay.
Birds are dinosaurs for precisely the same reason that you and I are mammals. Our ancestors were mammals, therefore we are mammals. Bird ancestors were small meat-eating dinosaurs, small theropod dinosaurs. Therefore, birds belong to that group. What's interesting is that it's not to say that – well, let me rephrase that. It's not to say that there weren't extinctions among dinosaurs 65 million years ago. Okay, anything that was unable to fly probably didn't make it across that boundary. Anything that was larger than a certain body mass didn't make it across. The only ones that made it across were able to fly and were fairly small. Nevertheless, dinosaurs did persist. Another misconception is that all the different kinds of dinosaurs you can think of all lived at the same time. So, for example, one of the more popular ones is something called Stegosaurus. It's the one that has the plates on the back and the spikes on the tip of the tail. Tyrannosaurus rex and Stegosaurus would never have seen each other because the whole group that includes Stegosaurus was extinct for tens of millions of years by the time T. rex was on the landscape. Okay, so there were hundreds and hundreds of different types of dinosaurs in the period of time, but they didn't all coincide. And they also differed, especially toward the end of that period. They began to look differently geographically as well. So if you were to go back to the end of the age of dinosaurs in Patagonia, you would have seen some really big predatory dinosaurs, things like Giganotosaurus and things like that, but they were unrelated to T-Rex.
So when you're out for a walk on a nice day in Iowa, maybe bird watching, what can you tell about birds that you say are dinosaurs in a way that tells us how dinosaurs might have behaved? Can you imagine dinosaurs by looking at a bird's behavior?
Some of them, yes. Some of them, yes. I wouldn't want to do that with the bigger sauropods, the ones with the long necks.
Mm-hmm.
I think the physiologies were very different there. But if you think about some of the smaller, the so-called raptors from Jurassic Park, you know, the velociraptor-type dinosaurs, we actually have fossils of these animals with feathers. We know that these animals had feathers. We know that some of these dromaeosaurids might have even been able to fly or glide. They had wing-like structures. And the more closely we look at these animals, the more bird-like they become. So I think to a certain extent in terms of maybe their vocal behavior, in terms of their movements, how they move themselves in the landscape and how these animals would have perceived their own world, it probably was very similar to what we see in birds.
In the last 30, 40, 50 years, how much has our understanding of dinosaurs progressed?
It has been overturned completely. I would say a few things. There are several things that have revolutionized our understanding of dinosaurs. The first was the realization that birds are dinosaurs.
Happened when?
The revolution on that started around 1970. And it by the mid-80s, it was pretty much a done deal. There are still a few people who argue against it, but it's pretty much the consensus view. Along with that came the argument that dinosaurs, other than birds, might have been warm-blooded. And that led to a lot of speculation about, you know, rethinking dinosaurs instead of being these old-fashioned, cold-blooded, archaic creatures that, you know, lumber along the landscape and only died because they weren't good enough to compete with us mammals. That actually these were very dynamic animals, that these were very sophisticated in many ways, and that they had been underestimated in terms of their advancement, for lack of a better term. That's not the best term, but it's the only thing that's coming to mind. I'd say the asteroid impact scenario was another big factor in that too. Whether we think that was the main cause of extinction or not, it added a level of analytical rigor to what had previously been a bunch of just speculation. People were just coming up with ideas with no evidence. This is one that actually had some evidence, that had hypotheses you could test with data. That was a critically important transformation. And finally, there were these discoveries, especially in China, of small feathered dinosaurs, which not only confirmed the idea that birds are dinosaurs, but began a wholesale reevaluation of how these things looked. You know, they weren't scaly. Well, they had scales, but some of them also had feathers or something like feathers. And so they didn't look like what we thought they looked like.
We had, of course, the Russian asteroid meteor come through the atmosphere by surprise a few days ago, caused quite a stir in the media. Can we learn anything about the asteroid impact of a much more massive asteroid 66 million years ago from this? Does that tell us anything, or just the size is so different that it's
The short answer is yes, and the long answer is you'd have to ask somebody who actually works on those things.
Okay, good.
Sorry, it would have scared me to death seeing it. I know that much, but. And I'm sure it would have terrified any other organism who was in its presence. But I don't know what that actually tells us. That's not my field, really.
Do you spend any time imagining what that asteroid 5 miles across slamming into the Earth must have been like for creatures to witness? Had we had some kind of camera on it on the horizon hitting this side of the Earth or the other side of the Earth? What would we have seen?
Well, if you were anywhere, I guess, in the central Western Hemisphere, you probably would have seen a big flash on the horizon. I don't know whether you would have seen a big cloud or what, but there certainly would have been some sort of explosion visible. I don't know how far the shockwave would have gone. There have been estimates that it would have leveled forests as far north as North America, part of North America, but I don't know about that myself.
In any case, a huge dead zone.
It probably would have wiped out a lot of life locally, and by locally I mean, you know, a large part of the Western Hemisphere for sure. Mm-hmm. On the other side, I don't know what would have been felt. I honestly don't know.
Mm-hmm. For instance, I'm thinking of the volcanic eruptions that then take a few days for the clouds to sift and to circulate around the globe.
Sure. Yeah. So it probably wouldn't have been immediate if you were in, say, Australia or Far Eastern Asia. It probably would have been a few days before you would see the sky going dark on you.
Mm-hmm. What is left of that? What is the record down on the Yucatan Peninsula that tells us that how big that meteor was, that asteroid?
Well, you're not going to see anything if you go to the Yucatan Peninsula. It's what we call a subsurface structure. It's all been covered up by later sedimentary deposits. So it's observed indirectly using various geophysical methods, using various drilling techniques. We have a pretty good view of what it looks like reconstructed from these different sources of evidence. The pictures that I've seen suggest a big circular structure that pretty much covers the entire northeastern corner of the Yucatan Peninsula.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
But if you go there today, you're not going to see that, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. And there has been an asteroid or a meteor that hit Iowa.
Yes.
Where was that?
That was at a place called Manson.
Manson.
Near the town of Manson, Iowa. That was actually a few million years older than the mass extinction.
And in the same way, if you walked over it, you wouldn't even know.
No, it's been covered up by deposits primarily during the Ice Age. But again, in subsurface, there's a lot of evidence for that structure.
Okay, very good. Anything left unsaid in the 30 seconds we have left?
Can't think of anything.
Okay. Thank you very much for this conversation. Fascinating to talk about climate change, not in our day and age, but 65, 66 million years ago and what we can tell from the fossil record. Chris Brochu is a associate professor of geology at the University of Iowa. He specializes in vertebrate paleontology. Chris, thank you for coming in today.
You're very welcome.
River to River is produced by Sarah Bowden and Emily Woodbury. Technical support from Dennis Reese. In Ames, we had help from Jason Burns. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. Podcasting and on-demand audio available by going to iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music is written and performed by the River Monks, and we always welcome your comments and questions about this program. Perhaps you have a suggestion for a future program. Contact us anytime through this email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.